Hello and welcome to another episode of the Menswear Style Podcast with me, your host, Pete Brooker. And on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about mod clothing, the history of mod clothing, and what exactly is a mod. We're going to be speaking to some founders and creative designers from some of the biggest names within the mod clothing industry. We have Phil Bickley, co-founder of Real Stars Are Rare, the brand whose other co-founder is none other than the mod father himself, Paul Weller.
Right from the start, we didn't want it to be just about Paul Weller. Real Stars Are Rare, and we believe it now, and going forward it's going to be more the case. Real Stars Are Rare is Real Stars Are Rare. We want it to be a brand in its own right. We want it to be able to stand up independently of Paul.
We're also going to be joined by Phil Daniels, star of Quadrophenia. So Phil, which way do you reckon the mod clothing industry is heading?
Well, I don't know, it seems like everything's going backwards, that's all.
Hold that thought, Phil. We're also going to be speaking to Andy Thompson. He's the head of UK for Merck. I'm going to ask him exactly what a mod is.
You know, you're kind of against society and the way people dressed. And it was a way to look smart, actually. You know, the hairstyle and everything, I think, was influenced by the times of like the new small faces and people like that. And your enemies were the rockers. So you were the ones that were smart guys and you wear suits, and it was to look sharp. It was to look edgy, and it was to be noticed, really.
That interview coming up shortly. So Phil, you're a little bit quiet over there. What are your thoughts on what a mod is?
Well, I can't think straight, that's all. I mean, nothing seems right apart from Brighton.
All right, Phil, yeah, we'll come back to Brighton in a bit. We're also going to be talking to Paul Brown over at Adapter Clothing. He's going to give us his take on what a mod is.
You know, most kids, if you grabbed them and said, you know, do you know what mod is? They would say no. And that's quite a healthy environment for mod to exist in, because they're going to start asking questions and they're going to want to start getting involved in it.
That interview with Paul Brown coming up shortly.
Yeah, Pete, what about Brighton this weekend, eh?
Brighton, Brighton, Brighton. That's all I ever hear from you. Although we will be speaking to Stephen Hattersley from Carnaby Designs. We're going to be talking helmets and all things scooters.
Stephen, thanks for taking the time out. How would you like me to introduce you to the podcast? Is it Stephen? Your surname's just escaped me. Where is it?
It's Hattersley. Stephen Hattersley. As in Roy, no relation. Don't put that in the introduction.
Sorry, Stephen, couldn't resist. You like scooters, don't you, Phil?
You've killed me, scooter!
Exactly. And lastly, we're going to be talking to Michael Stone over at Brutus. He's going to tell us whether there's any collaborations with Sting in the pipeline. And can we expect another single or collaboration with Sting anytime soon?
Maybe not Sting.
Is he not? It's not cool anymore.
Yeah, certainly not Sting. But I don't know. I think they'd probably come up with somebody a lot cooler than that.
So a bumper-packed show coming up for you today. Are you ready for this one, Phil?
Well, why don't you just turn over and do a few underwater farts, eh?
Tell him, Ray.
Why don't you just fuck off?
Yeah, fuck off. Ah, Quadrophenia. Okay, so let's start the podcast with that interview with co-founder of Real Stars Are Rare, Phil Bickley. So on the podcast now, we have Phil Bickley, co-founder of Real Stars Are Rare. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent.
How are you doing?
I'm awesome. Thanks for taking the time out to speak to me. So, Phil, tell us a little bit, please, about Real Stars Are Rare. How long has it been going and how you founded the brand?
Real Stars Are Rare formed in 2014. We launched September 14. And it was just something we started after a conversation with Paul in the shop. I've got my shop on Portobello Road called Tonic, and Paul was a frequent visitor, and we would spend a lot of time. He'd come in, we'd have a coffee and chat about clothes and ideas and different aspects of making clothes, and it was an idea that kind of grew from those early conversations. Paul had always wanted to, you know, he's been involved in various clothing collaborations prior to Real Stars Are Rare, and he'd always quite fancied doing something a little bit more in line with what he his vision for what nice clothes are. So it came out of those early conversations, and it was an idea that sort of gained traction over time until we got to a point and said, well, let's do it.
Tell us a little bit about the ambition of the brand. You're not looking to do anything massive in terms of mass production, but something more limited and a bit more exclusive. Is that the plan still?
Yeah, I mean, it was always the ethos behind Real Stars of Rare was always, and it still is, making good clothes and good quality clothes and class. You know, it's pretty classic. It's understated and it's about using good fabrics, not making big numbers. I mean, people even our existing customers now don't really realize just how few of an item we actually make. You know, we might make 50 of a top, and that's always the way we wanted to do it. It's kind of limited edition by its nature. And that's something that we think is quite cool. You know, it's something that goes against sort of the mass production model that is out there. You know, people are just making big numbers of items, and that's not something that we wanted. We always wanted to make, limited runs of good quality.
Yeah. Phil, we spoke briefly yesterday about the brand and a couple of times before. Obviously, having Paul on board, you're going to have that connection with mod clothing, but it's not necessarily tailored for mods, is it?
No, not at all. You know, it's Paul. Everything that Paul does has its kind of origins in mod, and he would, you know, he'd be first to admit that, and that's fine. You know, that's totally cool, but. For Real Stars Are Rare, it nods in that direction, but it's not purely about that. It's about classic clothes that are good quality and that anyone would buy into. It's stuff that's wearable. It's stuff that people will invest money in because it's well made and it's a good fabric and it nods in that direction.
And how hands-on is he with the designs, and how many conversations do you have with him about the designs and about the brand itself? Is it like does he pick up the phone to you like once a week, or how does it work?
Well, he's got his other job, which takes up a bit of his time as well. So we kind of fit it in around that, but you know, I've got my other job. You know, Tonic is my business, so we kind of make it work. We fit it around our full time jobs, if you know what I mean. But he's very hands on. He comes up with the ideas, the concepts. You know, Paul's got a pretty good back catalogue of clothes himself. You know, some of the things he's had for years, some of the manure things, and we they're where the early ideas come from. And Paul's, you know, those kind of people are creative, and he's creative in the obviousness his music career, but he's also creative in other things he turns his eye to. So you know, he'll sit and. While he's away touring or whatever, he's constantly scribbling things down and ideas and little sketches and stuff. And quite often we'll get together and he'll give me a load of sketches and go, oh, I've thought about doing something like this, and what do you think about this? And then we'll, you know, I'll look at the idea and work out how it could be taken from that sketch into a garment through, you know, my production background and my ability to realize the drawing. But yeah, all the ideas initially they'll come from him, but then I'll say, well, maybe what about this and what about this, and or we'll see something and go, oh, this would be cool, and he go, oh yeah, that'd be great. So it's Yeah, a lot of the original ideas come from his sketches or whatever.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, I remember meeting Paul at your launch at Somerset House and speaking to him, and he said, look, I'm not going to create anything or put my name on anything that I wouldn't wear myself. But when I first saw the website was released, it was almost like Paul was hidden. He was like overly modest, that he wasn't at the front of the brand. Looking at your website now, he's obviously got himself on the homepage wearing a lot of the clobber. Was that a conscious decision, or was he just thinking, look, I like the look of this stuff, let's get the cash register front and center?
I guess it was a bit of both, actually. When we first launched, we didn't want to overplay the Paul Weller thing. We wanted it was partly, I guess, you know, he's also worried about any implications that anything else he does beyond what he's completely in control of truly reflects what he's about. So when we first launched Real Stars Array, it was like, well, let's just kind of do it a little bit low key and see where it goes from there. And then as we've kind of done more things and we're happy that it was able to represent him personally and his own brand as such, you know, Paul Weller is a, you know, brand in himself, that, you know, as that aligned more with him, as Real Stars Are Rare aligned more with him, then we were able to start using his name power. a little bit more. And also, it's, you know, it's good for the brand, but it was a good, you know, we never wanted to overplay it, and we don't want to overplay it. We, you know, we're working at the moment about taking the brand forward, and it was always about, right from the start, we didn't want it to be just about Paul Weller. You know, Real Stars Are Rare, and we believe it now, and going forward it's going to be more the case. Real Stars Are Rare is Real Stars Are Rare. We want it to be a brand in its own right. We want it to be able to stand up independently of Paul, and stand up as a respected clothes brand that makes clothes for the right reasons, with the right kind of quality that people like, and the fact that Paul Weller's involved is just an interesting side fact.
Yeah. And for the future of Real Stars Are Rare, I see it's on your site, and if anyone else wants to check that out, it's obviously realstarsarare.com, but also tonicuk.com. Are you looking to get it out in other outlets, or do you like that exclusivity that it's under your roof?
A bit of both. Yeah, the next 12 months we're looking at ways now to take the brand to the next level as such. We've been out there for 2 years now. We did consider wholesale at the start, but we made a decision not to go down that route. And that's one of the benefits that having Paul's name has given us, because, you know, we didn't need to have to go down the wholesale route straight away. So, but it is something that we're looking to grow in the next year. But we're not going to expand quickly. We're going to, you know, if we do take on wholesale customers, they'll be the ones that understand the product and that are buying it for the right reason, because Real Stars Are Rare is a great brand in its own right, and not buying it because it's Paul Weller clothes brand.
A tenuous tangential mod clothing question. How many times have you seen Quadrophenia?
I don't know. Not very many, maybe twice. I was never really into that film that much, actually. What's the director's name of it? Do you know?
Is it Frank Rodham?
Frank is actually a customer of mine at Tonic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we talk about it a bit, actually. And he's been coming to me for a few years, actually. I was never really... I kind of like it. It's all right. It's a good film, but I was never that into it. I maybe seen it twice.
Well, Phil, if you ever get hold of Frank in the next couple of hours. Tell him I've been desperately trying to get him on the podcast. So.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So if you could facilitate that, that would be awesome.
Yeah, well, I'll do my best.
In the meantime, people should still check out your site and your shop on Portobello Road. It's Tonic, yeah. Tonic and tonicuk.com. You've got some great brands on there, mate. I love Universal Works. Barracuda's on there as well, as many others. So everyone should head over there and check out the stuff. Thanks, Phil.
Problems, mate.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Cheers. Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Phil Bickley there. Well, we've got a lot to cram in this week, so we're going to shoot on through to the second interview, which is with Andrew Tompsett from Merck. Okay, so on the podcast now we have Andrew Tompsett, head of UK and wholesale for Merck. How are you doing, Andrew?
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much indeed.
Andrew, could you just give us a little bit of insight about Merck, the history, and just kind of colour us in with the background, how it started, please?
Yeah, sure. It was set up in 1967 by a wonderful man called Jarvid Alavi. He came over penniless from what was Iran, and obviously saw an opportunity in this country. And he came to work originally in a restaurant, actually, initially. And very quickly, he got into the clothing trade and set up a stall in Ganton Street near Carnaby Street. And during that time, in the late 60s, we all know what was going on there. And even though he was selling mods and inventing his rumored button-down shirts and things like that, you know, he was also importing jeans from America, original Levi's, for like £2 and selling them for £5.
Oh, great.
So he was really a clothing entrepreneur. And naturally, at those times, the late 60s, certainly before he got one of his first stores, he managed to find that, you know, it was the mods, the skinheads, the Northern Soul crowd, you know, all the Oiks, I think, or a wonderful Glaswegian customer gave us another name for him, which I can't remember right now. But basically, all the kind of fashion people of that day seemed to gravitate towards Carnaby Street, and he kind of got involved in that motion. I mean, he worked with brands like Ben Sherman. He's worked with brands like Farrah. We stopped those years ago back in the store. And he very quickly decided he needed to work with his own brand.
Right, okay. And what's his role within the company today? Is he still quite hands-on? Does he do anything with the designs?
Less so. Jarvid is always hands-on. You know, when he comes here, we stand to attention. You have to have everything ready to tell him. His mind is absolutely remarkable. He's a wonderful human being and frankly, a great inspiration. At the moment, the business is run by his two children and their siblings, and you know, we're very much involved. You know, there's a lot of what we do is what we did before, but also we're introducing a lot of new things as well.
So Andrew, when people ask you, I've had this question asked to me a few times, I've never had a really good answer, even though I kind of know the technical answer. What is a mod? Could you crystallize that, or do you have a stock answer when people ask that to you?
I don't have it's a very, very good question. What is a mod? It kind of came through in the sort of early 60s, and it was really a way of dressing and a code, I believe. And you know, you were sort of kind of, you know, you were kind of against society and the way people dressed. And it was a way to look smart, actually, you know. The hairstyle and everything, I think, was influenced by the times of like the new small faces and people like that. You know, and your enemies were the rockers. So you were the ones that were smart guys, and you wear suits, and it was to look sharp. It was to look edgy, and it was to be noticed, really, when things were obviously quite difficult. And at the time, if you think that, you know, it didn't last very long, because you had like the love and all the big festivals in the States, you know, and it was all hippie for a while. So the mods really kind of stuck out and really, if you like, became unfashionable incredibly quickly. And I think that's why it became a cult thing.
Yeah. And how is it different now? I mean, is there still any animosity between the mods and the rockers, or is that even a thing anymore? Or did that die out in Brighton?
I don't think so. But I mean, mods are just one of the British subcultures that exist. You know, I mean, I remember growing up, you know, near Chelsea, and you had the skinheads in Chelsea Football Club, and they were fearsome people. you know, and they, the skinheads of today are actually just people, how they look with tattoos. I mean, if you saw someone today with tattoos and a shaved head in a Merc Neddy shirt, you'd have been terrified years ago. Whereas now it's just a way of expressing ourselves, much like the punks did, and your Northern Soul Brothers, your Scar, you know, with all of that movement. And the wonderful thing about Merc is, yes, he kind of was established during that mod time, but you've got to remember it was only 2 or 3 years. And even today, you've got people like Paul Weller and, you know, people like that who still like that ethos and that look and that point of difference in society.
Where do you think mod clothing kind of sits within the industry today? Do you think it had a peak in the 90s and then maybe a dip? And is there a renaissance going on now? How do you perceive it from your industry?
It's certainly a renaissance, and we struggle with names to call it. I mean, a hideous one is modern mod. You know, I think you know there's harking. Sorry,
I've not heard of the modern mod.
Yes, well, we kind of use that internally. I mean, because you've got a lot of new brands and retailers have created brands, and there's obviously a lot of interest. And I think, to be honest, because there's so little in fashion going on, really. I mean, apart from getting men into skinny jeans, nothing's much happened in the last 10 years in fashion sense. So I think people hark back to the past of like when clothes and style were interesting, which it certainly was at the, you know, in those times. And I think that's why it is relevant today, but it's not just mod. You know, you've got the skinhead revival, you've got the Scar revival, and Pauline Black's always on TV. You know, there's a lot of interest in it. And I think you've got nostalgia from the 40, 50, 60 year old. And then you've got the younger generation, you know, who still want to relive those fantastic times, I guess.
It always seems to me that there's been a marriage, like a symbiotic relationship between music and the clothing industry. So especially with like mod clothing, is there any bands out there? I mean, I've kind of gone off the radar with bands recently. I think it's an old age thing. But any bands coming up, like any modern day contemporary bands that are embracing the mod culture that you look towards?
There's been a good few. I mean, you know, one that springs to mind because we've used their music in various sort of lookbooks and things we've done is the Rifles, of course. I wouldn't say they're an out-and-out mod band, but they certainly wear the look. And a terrific brand, still filling, you know, big venues and doing extremely well. That's an example. And over the time, I mean, you've had lots of different... I mean, you know, Damon Albarn was always in the shop wearing his Merc Harrington. We kind of go through sort of different generations, and like you said, you know, music has changed enormously, but definitely clothing is associated with music. And the difference is there's just so many bands. You've got, you know, the Spitfires in from Ireland. You've got all these different smaller bands, and there's so many of them. You know, Joe Boyd always wears Merc Harrington's on every one of his sort of gigs and everything, and he's another example of a younger artist that we help and support wherever we can. I mean, there's an army of them, an absolute army of them.
Cool. Well, look, I've heard of the Rifles, so I'll have to have a look at all the other bands.
There we are. Check them out.
Thanks. Normally, I just turn to my my nephew and niece and say, "What's happening in the music industry these days?" I mean, they're only like eight and five, but.
You know, I'm very close to the music industry. We're all going to a gig tomorrow night, the Discovery 2 at 229. I mean, we're always in these young kind of showcase nights, and we're always looking and supporting and getting involved with young bands. And Merc in the past has sponsored the Cure Awards. We're very much involved with music. That makes us tick, to be honest. It's always on in the office. And, you know, I'm sitting in front of a very worn out Quadrophenia poster. You know, you know, music is abound, and you think with Spotify and how it's all changed nowadays, everyone's got so much more access to different music.
Well, Andrew, that's going to lead me on to my last question, the most tangential question. I've asked every other guest this, but how many times have you seen Quadrophenia?
Oh, very good question. Oh, it's got to be about 8. And I've seen stage plays, I've seen stage productions, local ones as well as big ones, and it's always out there, and it's a very important film.
Any future collaborations in mind for Merc? And what can we expect for the next season?
Well, it's an interesting time for us because 2017 is the 50th anniversary of the brand, obviously, as we started in 67. So we've got some new collections, some new exclusive collections, which we're working with you know, some fairly major players. There's going to be a bit of excitement out there. I can't reveal everything because it'll spoil the party, but we are looking at doing sort of various commemoration things. We've done a 50th Harrington. That's a unique piece that we pre-sold incredibly well into retail. So that'll be out in sort of February, March into the shops. So watch this space. But 50 years, and you know, there are other companies that are also a similar age that we're also discussing with collaborations and things like that. So there's some exciting things in the pipeline.
Awesome. I guess if you want to watch this space, it'll be over at merck.com, where you can see all the collections over there.
Correct.
Excellent. Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for taking the time out. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you very much, Peter. Very nice to talk to you. And it's a great blog, and everyone should check it out.
Andrew Thompson there with some kind words about our blog, which actually can be found over at menswearstyle.co.uk if you're not there already. Okay, so what do you think of that, Phil?
Well, I don't want to be the same as everybody else. That's why I'm a mod, see?
Everybody else. Okay, so we're going to move on now. We're going to speak to Paul Brown from Adapter Clothing. Okay, joining us on the podcast now, we have Paul Brown, Creative Director from Adaptor Clothing. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm very good. How are you?
Good stuff. Yeah, very well, thanks. Paul, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, please, and tell us a bit about Adaptor Clothing?
I have been working here for 5 years. I used to work for Top Man, very much into the indie music culture, which is obviously intrinsically linked with the mod scene, most certainly. I joined... I'm working for my boss, Phil, here, and he and I work really, really well together. And when I joined, it was an eBay retailer primarily, but now we are really focused on the mod thing, definitely the skinhead thing, the rude boy thing, and just trying to create an environment where people that come to the website are kind of swallowed up in the whole culture around the clothing as well. I mean, you know, music, the street culture, the clothing, it's all part of the same thing. So that's my involvement here. I kind of creatively oversee what we produce and how we promote ourselves out there in the open.
Awesome. And if anyone wants to check that out, I highly recommend they do. It's adaptorclothing.com. And it's not just brands and clothing, like you say there. There's blogs on bands, interviews, everything, really. It's a big hub for mod culture. So I do recommend people check that out. So, Paul, personally, what got you into the mod culture?
Okay, well, like yourself, really, really into the indie thing, the music thing. You know, I was very, very young during the Britpop thing. I'm 30 now, so I was sort of 12, or not even 12, was I? Less than 10 when the Britpop thing really kicked off. Followed that all the way through. And, of course, alongside you pick up bands like The Who and The Kinks and everything else. And then the indie boom happened with bands like The Strokes, The White Stripes and everything else. And while, you know, they're not moddy bands, they are definitely influenced by kind of all things cool and retro. And you're looking at the way these guys dress and you think, well, you know, they look great on stage. They must live the lifestyle. And you kind of find out more about these bands and you realize that, you know, these guys live and breathe it every day. And again, the indie thing, the Britpop thing, the mod thing, they're all very, very similar. They're the same thing, just in a different decade. Mm. So, you know, and also it's that. You know, these guys look super, super cool as well. And it was really about trying to find out how to be as cool as these other guys.
You have like many other mod brands on your site, including your own Adaptor Clothing. What was the reasoning behind launching your own collection?
Okay, there are lots and lots of reasons. This is quite a competitive marketplace. You know, while there are probably only half a dozen other brands out there stocking, you know, similar lifestyle brands, for us setting up our own brand was an opportunity to kind of break away from that and not have to get too involved in the competition around that, and also just try and bring something new. And we've got plenty of ideas here, but none of these other brands are making this stuff. And to kind of elaborate on that a little bit, brands like Ben Sherman, Merck, Fred Perry, although, you know, you consider them the lifeblood of mod clothing, actually, they're kind of desperate to break away from that. and be something bigger than their mod heritage, which is great. But of course, you know, year on year, we were waiting for Ben Sherman, you know, to bring along the next best thing, you know, in the Czech shirts and that, and they just weren't delivering. So we just said, enough is enough. We'll go out there and we'll make our own thing. And it started with the suits. It grew into knitwear, into shirting. Our knitwear now is all made out of Italy. So we're talking, you know, again, about the heritage of, you know, what mod clothing should really, really be. Again, it just gives us that creative, I don't know what you want to call it, but, you know, the creative license, I suppose, to just try something different and test the market a little bit and put something different out there that's unique and interesting. And, you know, that's our viewpoint. You know, we're confident in doing that.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Italian influence there as well. I mean, that's kind of where it all began, really, for the mod culture in the 60s, when you have elements of the mod subculture that would be often tailor-made suits. And these suits would be Italian fabric and Italian tailoring as well.
Well, there's something sort of fascinating about that, actually, because, you know, people, I think, around the world, whether, you know, we've got customers in the States and in Europe and everything else, to them the mod thing is quintessentially British. For myself, while I appreciate that there is some truth to that, actually I feel that, like, if you were an original mod back in the 60s, you were looking to France and America and Italy for your inspiration. So actually you were trying to replicate everything that you saw outside of Britain and that wasn't British. And now 50 years down the line, mod is everyone, you know, around the world really trying to represent that British look, which I find really fascinating. It's kind of, you know, a weird backward situation in some ways.
It's almost chasing its own tail in a way, isn't it?
So. It is, exactly.
So how has the attitude changed? I mean, obviously you had the birth of it in the 60s, maybe a renaissance in the 90s with the Britpop culture. How is it now, and where do you think mod clothing sits within the industry?
Okay, so I think we're that far away now from the original movement that it is just considered classic British menswear. You know, although it's always been very, very streetwise and very, very cool and had a lot of attitude, it has become something that a guy in their 60s can wear as well as somebody who's 16. I know that there's you have to be careful with that, but fundamentally that's still true. So where it sits right now, as I say, is considered just to be very, very classic, you know, kind of timeless, and kind of hasn't dated, you know, because it's constantly brought up to date, you know, with brands like Fred Perry and Pretty Green, who have put their sort of modern spin on it. I actually, working in the mod market, I think probably its popularity at the minute in the contemporary world is probably the lowest it's been for 15 years, I would have said, 10, 15 years. It's, you know, people feel like they've kind of seen it all before, and it is kind of regurgitated in a sense from decade to decade. What needs to happen for the mod scene now to really take off is for some young guys to get back into it, which I know is happening already. But it's a case of, you know, Britpop wasn't out and out mod, but it had elements of it. Indie was not out and out mod, but again, it had, you know, influences. So there needs to be a musical movement, which we haven't seen since the likes of the indie movement 10 years ago, that really captures the imagination of you know, young kids right now that are maybe slightly alternatively minded or whatever. There needs to be a scene to come along which mod can kind of adapt and become part of, which it has done with every music scene since the 60s, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I kind of get the idea, because you can have too much of a good thing. Like, for example, when I was in the 90s and everyone and every other band was getting into the mod movement and, you know, wanting to look like Liam Gallagher, and then you'd think, crikey blimey, I need to find something else now because I'm just fitting in with everybody else. I guess everything has a cycle where it will come in, it will just be oversaturated, then people need to move away from it. The feel I have with mod movement is that it had such a peak, it had such a high watermark,
of popularity that it, you know, it had really nowhere else to go, and it kind of just everything, like everything else, it needs to have a bit of a rest, and then someone else needs to come back and pick it up by its shoestrings and say, do you remember this? This was cool.
Well, mod, if you look at what's in the shops right now, there'll always be something that's intrinsically mod. So whether it's the Harrington or the Desert Boots or the Parker, they're on constant cycle. So something from the mod look will always be in the contemporary market. I know Desert Boots were big a couple of years back. They've kind of had their day now, but there'll always be something. But mod needs to now become so obscure from the mainstream that it becomes attractive to those guys, again, that want to be alternative and different. You know, although I say its popularity is probably at the lowest it's been for about 10 years, it's almost got to a point now where it's, you know, most kids, if you grabbed them and said, you know, do you know what mod is? They would say no. And that's quite a healthy environment for mod to exist in, because they're going to start asking questions and they're going to want to start getting involved in it. And then it's a passion that's driven by their personal search rather than what all their mates are doing, if that makes sense.
So what's next for Adapter Clothing then, Paul?
Okay. We are, again, with a very competitive market, and we've got some of our competitors out there starting to develop their own brand stuff as well. We are conscious that we're wanting to keep one step ahead or two steps ahead where we can all the time. And, you know, actually, you know, we're confident that we're kind of number one in the market for what we do. And in order to maintain that, you have to be brave, you know, because actually the path isn't laid out in front of you. You've got to make it up. Whereas if you're being followed by your competitors, you know, they've got targets on your back, so they know exactly what to shoot for. But for us, we kind of have to, we're the creators of our own destiny. So we are looking into developing like our own fabric. So it's not about just product design anymore. We're talking about the fabrics that these things are made from and about getting those right before we even think about what the garment's going to look like. We're getting really granular with the design here of products. We're going to continue to produce stuff in Italy because, again, the heritage of that is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start experimenting with different ideas. And also part of the design thing that's going on as well, well, actually, it's probably easy to say that we've set up our own brand recently, which we're selling into other shops, called GetUp.
Okay.
This is really, really exciting and fun for us. So we're in kind of our first proper debut season will be in January. A lot of this stuff will be hitting shops. And what GetUp is I wouldn't call it a mod brand. It's just very retro inspired. So we're looking at all the things that were going on around mod at the same time. So, you know, we're looking to France, we're looking to Italy, we're looking to America. Some of the sportswear that people would be wearing, some of the slightly more unusual formal wear. So while all mods would look at it and get it and know exactly what it's all about, it's going to have broader appeal as well. So and part of the USP of this brand is going to be color, definitely. I mean, it's so easy when you run a mod brand to make everything in burgundy, navy and black, etc. We're wanting to look a little bit beyond that, and we're looking at nice browns, mustards, some greens, things like that. That's stuff that's going to be specific to the debut season in spring summer. Awesome. 17. That's very, very exciting. So there's plenty going on here as far as, you know, pushing the envelope out.
Fantastic. Your website once again is adapterclothing.com, and I strongly recommend everyone has a mooch over there and check out what you guys are doing, because it's the Lord's work, Paul, what you're doing.
Nice.
Lastly, Paul, a tangential question: how many times have you seen Quadrophenia?
I tell you what, it's something that I watch once a year, just to it's like medication almost. It refires you up, and just kind of reminds you, you know, there's Quadrophenia exists in its own bubble in a way, which is quite a nice thing about it. But, you know, the first time anyone sees that film, I don't care how mod or how modernist or super cool you are, that film was so, so cool the first time you watch it. And that will always be true. And it's a great film anyway, whether you're a mod or not.
Yeah.
Once a year, I make sure I just sit down, give it all my time. And again, it just reinvigorates the kind of excitement and the energy and the coolness about why we're all into this.
Paul Brown there from Adaptor Clothing. And now time for a word from our sponsor. It's powerful stuff. So now we're going to have a chat with Stephen Hattersley, Managing Director of Carnaby Designs.
On the podcast now, I'd like to introduce Stephen Hattersley, Managing Director of Carnaby Designs. How are you doing, Stephen?
Absolutely fine, Peter. How are you?
I'm brilliant, thanks. Carnabydesigns.co.uk is a place to go, and they specialise in classic helmets for the discerning scooter rider. So, Stephen, tell us a little bit, please, about yourself and the scooter, the Vespa. It's all part of the mod culture. Tell us a little bit about the company, please, and your role within it.
Well, I set the company up about 4 years ago. It's one of those situations you hear about where somebody wants them and you just can't find it. I've been riding scooters for about 12 years and I really wanted a full face helmet. I kind of value my chin and I know how much it can hurt when it lands on tarmac. And I just couldn't find a nice full face helmet that was scooter themed rather than motorbike themed. There were a million and one motorbike ones or plain ones, but I just wanted someone which sat a bit more comfortably with the whole scooter and Vespa ethos. So I just had voluntary redundancy from where I was working and I thought I'm actually going to do something about this. So I did. And that was 4 years ago. And we've sort of grown from there, really. So, yeah, it's going well.
Awesome. OK, you're just online. There's no flagship store or anything like that.
We don't have a flagship store, no, but we've got about 15 dealers around the country. They're a mix of, we try to sort of make it a bit different from normal. We've got some motorbike scooter dealers, but we've also got some mod clothing outlets, places like Adaptor Clothing and places like that, which just sort of on the same sort of level as us and just know what they're doing on that sort of level and that sort of style of customer, really.
Excellent. Cool. So, Steve, I just wanted to ask you really about mod clothing in general. And does anyone ever ask you what a mod is? And do you have like a stock reply?
I don't think anyone's got a decent reply to it, but I think they might have a stock reply. I think it's hard to classify, to be honest. I think it gets harder as time goes on. I mean, obviously, dating back to the 60s, I think the definition, whatever it was then, has probably changed significantly with each decade that's passed since then. And it really is hard to put your finger on it. I think it's more a state of mind and a way of wanting to be, really. And if that sounds like I'm ducking the question, then it's probably true. I am. I really don't know how to define it. And I'd challenge anyone to do it, really, because I think we get a whole range of people sort of buying our helmets, by way of example. And some of them are people who are around, maybe not in the 60s, but not far off it. And other people who are born sort of 30 years later. You know, it's a real mix of people, a real mix of styles. And very eclectic, but all have a sort of a common theme, really, of wanting to look sharp and want to look a certain way.
Stephen, do you mind me asking how old you are?
I forget myself sometimes. 47.
47. Okay, so what got you into the mod era or the mod culture?
The first time I was really into mods, it was through the scooter side of things, really. It was when I was a kid. I was about 11. I was waiting for the school bus, and the coolest kid in town was a guy called Andy Morgan. And he was about 18, and our mums worked together, they were teachers. So because our mums worked together, Andy would go past on his scooter, and he was the world's coolest person, I kid you not, and he would just give me this little raise of the finger, just a little wave to me as I went past, and I used to think, I want to be as cool as that, and I want a scooter as soon as I can. And it took me a bit longer to get one, but I loved it. Love having a scooter, and love the whole sort of the Vespa lifestyle as well.
Awesome, cool. Well, I mean, I guess that's part of maybe why we can't crystallise or define what a mod is because as soon as somebody starts broadcasting the fact I'm a mod, that's basically, it then becomes uncool, if you see what I mean.
I think it does, yeah. There's a subtlety to it, I think, and I'd be a little suspicious of anyone who sort of did broadcast it too loudly that they're a mod because they might be trying a bit too hard to be a mod, I think. If they were, so I think it's a little bit more subtle than that, to be honest.
Stephen, just lastly, how many times have you seen Quadrophenia?
not as many as some, only about probably about half a dozen times, I would say, no more than that, which is a lot less than some.
Okay, great.
I obviously don't have enough free time.
Yeah. Well, I assumed with someone of your pedigree in the website, it would be at least on a loop on a TV somewhere in the house. It would just be playing in the background, so you could watch it in every room. But
you would think so. But I think part of being a mod's avoiding cliches sometimes, so it might be just sort of one step too far, really.
Okay, great. Well, listen, cheers, Steve. And again, if anyone wants to check out your website, it's carnabydesigns.co.uk. And roughly, how much do the helmets retail at?
The helmets are all the same price, $89.99. And as I say, we've got about 15 dealers around the country, and there's a link to all of them on our website, and we sell them directly from there as well. So by all means, get in touch if anyone's interested.
Stephen Hattersley there, and I do recommend you go check out his website. One more time, Phil. My favourite quote from any movie. Okay, so we're going to finish off now with an interview with Michael Stone, head of design over at Brutus. Okay, so on the podcast now, I'd like to introduce Michael Stone. Michael Stone is head of design down at Brutus. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm really good, really good.
Okay, is that a lie? Because I know that you've got some cold and some lurgy going on there.
Yeah, I know, but we don't want to talk about that. I'm happy to be in London. It's a good place to be.
If you could just, for the uninitiated, tell us a little bit about Brutus, a little bit about the history of the brand, please.
Brutus, when I was growing up, Brutus were as big as Levi's. They were as big as Diesel. They were just huge. For many years, many, many years, they did the check shirts. You know, they were up there with Ben Sherman with a button-down mod shirt. Fabulous business. Then went into denim. And just apparently, I wasn't around at the time, but apparently they sold more jeans than Levi's at the time. I mean, they were just huge. Very iconic. They even had, we had like TV adverts and stuff, one of which had Sting in, very, very young Sting.
Oh, wow.
And spawned a number one hit, I think, called Got My Brutus Jeans On, which, you know, not many people are going to know about, but they'll all be Googling it now. And it was quite a famous hit. So they were a huge company. And about 20 years ago, the owners decided, look, you know, it were going to go in a different direction, and they did. And that was it. It just lay dormant for a while until 5 years ago when the son of the owner, Jonathan, son of Keith, brought it back again, went to exactly the same factories that we'd used 30, 40, 50 years ago to make the jeans, to make the shirts. And it's been going really, really well.
Sorry to cut you off, Michael. So around about 2000, I saw that they took a bit of a hiatus. How come Jonathan, who was it, the son of Keith Friedman, who was the founder?
That's it, yeah.
So what inspired him to give this brand the kiss of life again?
I think it's just the resurgence of nostalgic British heritage brands. You know, there are so many British brands that, you know, have just fallen by the wayside. And, you know, maybe Jonathan didn't want Brutus to be one of them. And he's done a fabulous job, really, really has. He's kept that purist element to it. You know, and he loves it, absolutely loves it. And he's going to grow it. And that's what I'm here for. And we're going to take it forward.
Well, it's interesting that Jonathan has gone back to Brutus. I mean, he must have a love affair. Obviously, it's in the family, it's in the blood, but he hasn't gone out and said, I'm going to design my own brand, I'm going to give it a different name even. He's said, right, yeah, well, there was nothing wrong with this model in the first place. Let's just reintroduce it. Let's give it a facelift, maybe tweak a few things here and there, I'm guessing. So,
yeah.
So you're pretty much hands-on with the design team around there. What have you done differently to bring Brutus back into the modern day?
New colours. New factories now, new fabrics. You know, things have moved on. Every part of fashion has moved on. So you do still have the core shirts that are the same fabrics and the same factory. But we've also got some new product that's using new fabrics that's got the latest, you know, developments from the factories in it. It's just up to date. you know, if the technology and the resources were around 50 years ago, Brutus would have used them 50 years ago.
And can we expect another single or collaboration with Sting anytime soon?
Maybe not Sting. Maybe not Sting.
It's not cool anymore.
Yeah, certainly not Sting. But I don't know. I think they'd probably come up with somebody a lot cooler than that.
Poor old Sting.
Really good.
Listen, just a little bit on mod clothing itself. How do you feel like the actual industry for mod clothing is going? How do you feel like it's peaked and it's troughed over the years? Is it heading for a peak now, or is it heading for a plateau, or is it doing a trough?
I don't think it's in a trough. Not with people like Fred Perry around. I don't think it will be in the trough. And you know, you've got the Lambrettas, and you know, Ben Sherman's going to be doing well again this year. Merck, Pretty Green. No, I don't think it's going to trough. Very much a plateau.
And how do you see the other brands compared to you as well? Do you look at the other brands and going, oh, that's good, they're doing well, that means we can do well? Or are your contemporaries your competition as well? When you look over your shoulder, you think, oh, these guys are killing it. How do we compete against them? How does it sit?
If I said that we didn't look at other people, I'd be lying. And, you know, if other people said they didn't look at us and other brands, they'd be lying. Of course you do. There's people you look at and you think, yeah, they're doing it right. I don't want to say who they are, don't give them a big head, but there's a couple of brands and you look at and you think, that's where I want to be. They're doing excellent work. And you know, on the flip side, you look at some brands and you think, you shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't have done that. But like I said, I don't want to name names.
We don't want to throw anyone under the bus. But if anyone wants to check out Brutus, I recommend they do. It's brutus.london. Is that right, Michael?
It is, yes.
And there you'll see the history of the brand. You'll see all of the collections that are coming out. Any news for what's coming up in the future, Michael, like AW's for Autumn Winter 17?
Autumn 17 is going to be excellent for us. That's going to be my first real season when I've had some proper impact. For Spring 17, we've just brought out a range of classics. So it's like everything that everybody is always asking us for. It's the house check shirts, the gingham shirts, the Oxford shirts, all the core staples, just to get us through to Autumn 17. So for Autumn 17, we're going to come out. We're going to have fabulous polos. We're going to have fabulous graphic tees. We're going to have some lovely outerwear. It's going to be great. Can't wait for Autumn 17. I started to get my protos and things in just this week. And yeah, really excited.
Brilliant. I look forward to seeing those, Mike. And thanks again for coming on. Just to finish, I have asked everyone this question, so it's quite tangential. But when was the last time you saw Quadrophenia, and how many times have you seen Quadrophenia?
I've not seen it for a few years, uh-huh. But I'm the youngest brother of an old mod who probably watched it and played it in our house, the album, a million times. I've not seen it for a while, but I have a very good memory of it. I know all the songs, and yeah, I'm very, very familiar with it.
Michael Stone there. Thank you, Michael. Thank you also to everyone else that chipped in this week. Thank you Phil Bickley from Real Stars Are Rare, Andy Tompsett from Merck, Paul Brown, Adapter Clothing, and Stephen Hattersley from Carnaby Designs. Crikey, it sounds like an acceptance speech. I'd like to thank my producer. I'd like to thank my writer, my wife, my gorgeous wife. Where is she? Okay, so this is it. This is it for this week's podcast. If you want to head over to the Menswear Style site, you'll find other podcasts, blogs, and really good competitions this week. So that's menswearstyle.co.uk. Follow us on the social at Menswear Style. Also, a quick thank you to Phil and Ray. Thanks, guys.
Why don't you just fuck off?
Yeah, fuck off.
Awesome stuff. Okay, also, if you'd like to leave us a lovely 5-star review on iTunes, that would help us get up the charts and keep me in a job. All the best, guys. Bye.